So let me introduce Dr. Bosnak. Since 1972, Zurich-trained Jungian analyst Robert Bosnak has led dream groups and explored dreaming with individuals in both analytical and didactic contexts, developing a method called embodied imagination. Embodied imagination in the work with dreams and waking memories is practiced individually and in groups in psychotherapy, medicine, theater, art, and creative research. It is a rehearsal technique for the Royal Shakespeare Company in England, applied in medical research and psychotherapy in Japan, China, and in a variety of locations in the Western world. It is also the focus of the dream work at the Santa Barbara and Malinalco Healing Sanctuary. Robert Bosnak has authored several books, which we have available in the back for you to buy. A Little Course in Dreams, Christopher's Dreams, Tracks in the Wilderness of Dreaming, Embodiment, Creative Imagination in Medicine, Art and Travel, and his latest book, Red Sulfur, which is a novel devoted to his interest in alchemy. Robert is an instructor of embodied imagination worldwide and was co-founder of the International Society for Embodied Imagination and National Nightmare Hotline. And since 1997, cyberdreamwork.com, the premier voice program on the internet for interactive work on dreams and imagery. He is past president of the International Association for the Study of Dreams and was visiting professor of clinical psychology at Kyoto University in Japan. After having been in private practice in Cambridge, Massachusetts for 26 years, he moved his work to Sydney, Australia, and is now based out of Santa Barbara, California, where he is the executive director of the Santa Barbara and Malinalco Healing Sanctuary. Please welcome Robert Bosnak.
Thank you very much for this introduction. Hold on, does this sound good? Because, okay. I left Boston in 2002, and coming back is very strange, actually. I was walking in Cambridge and seeing all the same places, but everything was different. Only the students were the same age, and I clearly wasn't. And that was always the problem in Cambridge, I found, because it was every year the same age came back in. I promised that I would say something about Jung for the 21st century, which is a very arrogant statement that I would know what Jung would be about in the 21st century. But let me give you a little bit of an idea of what I'm going to be talking about. I will first explain to you what embodied imagination is about and how it is part of the Jungian tradition, but a new form of it, as we need to develop Jung's thought all the time. And I will give you some case presentations, small case presentations, about this work for healing, for in theater. I think I'm going to talk about theater, but not much, about trauma, microbiology, physics, real estate, and the stock market. Because you can use this kind of work in all kinds of different contexts, and that's why I was talking about Jung in the 21st century. What will be the most important thing of Jung that keeps on going? I don't particularly think it is going to be his meta-psychology. I think the meta-psychology is interesting, but I don't know if it is going to last for very much longer. But what I do think will continue is Jung's phenomenology. Jung as a phenomenologist. Jung as a person who goes into the world of images and explores it as something that doesn't need any further explanation. And he encountered this first in his descriptions in the Red Book. And for those of you, I think that everybody knows what the Red Book is about, right? It's he started in 1912 to write down his fantasies and imaginations in little black books, and then he put it together in a Red Book. And the Red Book was published, I think, in 2013. And then we all started to read it because it became very interesting to see what Jung had been doing. And I will tell you two things of the Red Book that really interested me as somebody who's interested in the embodied imagination. Where does the embodied imagination come from? It actually starts when, and this he already told Aniela Jaffe, and it's in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, where he is in a very difficult situation in his life. He has separated from Freud, and he feels isolated. This is a feeling that he has because he still is the head of the Zurich school, and there are tons of people that are working with him and interested in him, but he feels isolated, and he gets all these images that come up. And what he does, and he describes it as follows, I am letting myself fall into this world of imagery. And as he falls, he sees himself moving along a cliff face. And so he's falling along a cliff face, and he sees all these things in the cliff. And then he comes down in something that is in German Schlamm, which is translated as mud. And he is to his ankles in the mud. And so that, to me, is the beginning of the notion of embodied imagination. He does not think about the imagination, but his feet enter into the imagination. His body enters into the imagination. His feet are up to his ankles in mud. So the imagination is fully embodied in its presence. The cliff face is a fully embodied cliff face. He can actually touch it. The ground he can touch. So he can feel that this imagination, this world is entirely real, just as real as it is in dreams. Because if you remember your last dream, then you will notice that it's not primarily a story. It is a place where you find yourself. You're somewhere. Somewhere and something happens. And my interest has been to go all over the world and ask people about their dreams, and then there's one answer that you always get, and that is, I was somewhere, and something happened, and then I woke up. So that is my definition of dreaming. Somewhere where something happens, and then you wake up. So the fact that you wake up indicates that you are not in a physical reality, but a reality that presents itself as physical. It is a quasi-physical reality. It is a reality that presents itself as if it were physical, but it feels physical. And that's why people say, I was somewhere. And this is true everywhere. I've never heard it anywhere that it is not true. So what can we do in order to... Oh, I have to stay away from those guys. What can we do to get back to that world? If we take that we know nothing about dreaming, and that's my primary perspective. I'm a Socratic, post-Socratic, and I believe that I know absolutely nothing. Nothing, nothing, zero, but with a passion. I know nothing. And so I know nothing about dreams. And so the only thing I can do is to try and get back to the dreaming. And of course, I know philosophically from Heraclitus already that you can't get back to the dream because you can never get back to the previous moment because you cannot step into the same river twice. So you can never get back to a dream, but you can get into a flashback. And we know flashbacks from the study of trauma, and for those of you who have had trauma, you know that in a flash, suddenly you can be back in the traumatic situation. It surrounds you, you're there again, and you can feel it with your whole body. You can hear things, you can smell things. Your whole body is back there. That's a flashback. And it's used a lot in movies. But this, which interests me, of course, because now I'm living right in movie country. So what we're trying to do is to artificially help a person to get into a flashback. And that I will start my description of the work that I'm doing. I will start with a description of a person who was at the Santa Barbara Healing Sanctuary. Now, the Santa Barbara Healing Sanctuary was started with Jill Fisher, who is with us and who has been my closest collaborator now for 25 years, 30 years, long time. We've worked out this method together, and Jill is really good at it. And I hear that she's going to do more of it here in Boston, so that makes me very happy. So we started the Santa Barbara Healing Sanctuary, and then we found that it was excessively expensive in Santa Barbara, so we also started it in a place called Malinalco in Mexico, where it's much cheaper. I shouldn't tell this to Donald Trump. So, but this was from the Santa Barbara Healing Sanctuary. This was from something that we did in Santa Barbara. This is a woman who has a severe case of MS, and the people who come to the Healing Sanctuary are not all of them people who have physical illnesses, but some of them do. And healing sanctuaries existed 2,500 years ago. For about 1,000 years, it was the main way of doing medicine in the West, in the healing sanctuaries. And what happened in the healing sanctuaries was that people would go and sleep in a place that was called an abaton. And the healing sanctuaries, by the way, were dedicated to the god Asclepius. And Asclepius was a legendary healer, probably. If he existed, he would have existed about 1300 BC, because the Iliad says that his sons were part of the Trojan War. And then he got promoted to from a legend to a god. He entered Olympus, and he became the god of healing with his daughter Hygieia, who was probably an independent goddess who had migrated from what we now call the Middle East. And they together were the gods of the healing sanctuary. And in the abaton, which is a place in the healing sanctuary that comes from the word abateng, which means inaccessible or untrodden, the place that you can't get to with your rational consciousness, that you can't get to on your own, but where you need the help of the healing god. And the healing god for us would be the healing response or the healing imagination. And I believe that if you enter into that deep imagination, that embodied imagination, healing can take place. So we are continuing this Asclepian tradition. And in the healing sanctuaries, and there were some people that are here that were at the healing sanctuaries that we did, in the healing sanctuaries, people would sleep and they would have a visitation by the god, or by the goddess, or by a snake, or by a dog, or by their uncle. But they would get these dreams, and then the priests would work with those dreams. And we do the same thing. We have people sleep in an abaton, which used to be a place underground, but sometimes we don't do it underground. Sometimes we do, but sometimes we don't. In Mexico, we do it at the bottom of a huge cliff. And there people have dreams. The first dream that this person had was a dream about a woman in Africa. She is a Caucasian woman. She dreams about a woman in Africa, a very strong, big woman. You have to see that by the time that this woman arrives at our healing sanctuary, it's very difficult for her to walk. And her movement is severely impaired. Next to the work that we're doing with dreams, we also do things like massage and meditation, and there is a doctor, and there is dance and movement and yoga and watsu, which is water-based therapies. Next to all the dreaming, and then there's dream theater and journaling. But it's all based on the dreaming that you have. And so as she dreams about this African woman, we begin to do the work. And so first I ask her, where is she? And she describes that this African woman is in a natural setting, and I ask her about this natural setting. She describes the natural setting, and that's how we begin. So we're trying to get to a flashback, so we're trying to get back to this place where this African woman is directly present. And so as I ask her, what is the light like? What is around her? What are the trees like? And then we begin to become more specific about this environment, more specific about the trees, more specific about what is on the ground, more specific about all these different elements that are in the dream, in the same way that Jung would be looking at the rock face. We take it as entirely real. We don't take it as a representation. I'm not interested in what anything represents. We take it as a presentation, because we take it as phenomenologists. That's why I was saying, coming back, that I believe is what is going to continue with Jung in the 21st century. It is seeing dreams as presentations, not as representations. Because if you ask people what it represents, you get 500 different explanations and 500 different interpretations. So the question of what it represents, I throw out. And Jung found that actually in the Red Book, he meets in the Red Book, or in his imagination, a prophet and his daughter. And he says to this prophet, oh, you are the symbol of, and the prophet says, I'm not a symbol, I'm real. And then Jung said, oh, yeah, sure, sure. And one page later he says, again, you're the symbol of, and he said, well, you can call me a symbol, you can call me whatever you want, but I am me. So these presences are real presences, and this, I digress all the time. This became very clear to me when, and I describe this in my book, Tracks in the Wilderness of Dreaming, I am walking around, this is my dream, of course at the moment I don't know that it is a dream. I'm walking around in Leiden University, where I went to college and where I studied law, and I see a bridge, and I'm walking on the bridge, and suddenly I realize that I'm dreaming, so I become lucid. I realize that I'm dreaming, and I touch the bridge, and I feel that it's stone, and I feel that it's entirely real. And I stamp my foot, and I feel that the ground is entirely real. Everything around me is real, and I know that I'm dreaming. So I see a cab driver come up in a yellow cab. In Leiden, it's complete anomaly, but I don't notice that. And I say, stop, stop, stop. And the cab driver stops and rolls down his window. And I say, I'm dreaming. This is a dream. You're part of my dream. And he looks at me. And then he rolls up his window and he drives off, realizing, obviously, that this guy is crazy. I mean, to him, this is his world. He lives there. This is his reality. And that a guy runs up to him saying that this is a dream has nothing to do with him. For him, he's riding a cab. He's driving a cab. He's rolling down his window. He's rolling up his window. He's driving a cab. This is reality. And so that's the perspective that I go from, that these are realities. These are real beings existing in a world that I don't know what it is. I don't know who these beings are. I don't know whether they're spirits. I don't know if they exist even a moment after the dream. I don't know. I know nothing about them. I just know that there's an encounter, and in the encounter, they are entirely real, these beings. So, go back to the woman in the healing sanctuary. So, I ask her, how is she standing, this woman? She's standing on her feet, and her feet are very planted on the ground. She's standing next to the trees, and then I do something that comes from acting, Janet is not here, no. We developed this technique at MIT, Janet Zonenberg and I. Janet still is here. She was the head of the drama and the music department of MIT, which is very strong and very good, which you wouldn't expect that from MIT, but it's really, really good. And so we developed this with her students, and she wrote a book, Dream Work for Actors. And then once we finished that, we were invited to the Royal Shakespeare Company in England, in Stratford, to develop it as a rehearsal technique. But so we learned a lot from acting and from actors. So we're doing something that is called mimesis, or imitation. We first begin to imitate, with very subtle movements, the African woman as she stands there, the way that she stands there, her posture, and she begins to feel that posture, and she begins to sense that posture in her body, and as she senses that posture in her body, something begins to shift in her. Something is no longer this woman who is very disabled, but you can begin to feel and sense how this body of the African woman begins to enter her and begins to possess her and begins to take her over. And that is a big shift, because she has not been in a body like that before, or not for many, many years. Let me keep track of time. There's no clock here, right? Let me digress again. And this is, I'm moving over to somebody that I worked with in Shizuoka in Japan. This is a man who has a tumor on his anus that is as big as, very big. And so he can't move anymore. And he's completely flat out on his bed, and he doesn't want to have an operation. He pushes everybody away. He's in the final phases of his life. And the doctor who's working with him in palliative care asks me, it's the time that I'm teaching in Kyoto at Kyoto University, asked me to come over to Shizuoka to work with him. And I ask him if he has had a dream. And he says, well, I had a dream a few nights ago. It's the only dream that I remember in months. And that is, I see two headlights coming towards me. And then I notice that these headlights are not the lights of a car, but the eyes of a cat. And then I see the cat move from one part of the room to the other part of the room. It's the end of the dream. No, the end of the dream is that he calls out for his wife, and his wife isn't there, which is very unusual because his wife is taking care of him. And he's very surprised because he wants to show her the cat. So the cat is really important to him. So I say to focus on the cat and begin to sense the cat. And he says, but I am not the cat, right? And that's really important. Because for instance, in Gestalt, you would say that these are all parts of myself or parts of the dreamer. And that we don't know. We have no idea. So I say to him, that's true, you are not the cat. The cat is the cat and you're lying in the bed. He's identified with the one who's lying on the bed. So I say to him, no, you're not the cat, but maybe it's possible for you to imitate the cat. And he will think about it, and a week later I see him again. And he said, I'll try it. So he begins to focus on the cat, and he begins to feel and sense the movement of the cat, and very subtly, because he can't move, very subtly, so he begins to sense how the cat is moving through the room. And as he senses how the cat is moving through the room and how his body slowly becomes taken over by the cat and the cat takes possession of his body, he can feel how there's freedom coming in his body because the cat begins to take over as he moves. The cat moves. And so I say to him, now stay with it and keep on sensing that. And he keeps sensing this for a while. And then I tell him and his doctor and the nurses to keep rehearsing that with him as if it were a play in which he has to be playing the cat. And so they do that for a period of time, and the physician reports the following. He decides that he does want the operation. But that's not the most important part. The most important part is that he becomes emotionally more flexible, and he can let his family come closer, and he gets into more relationship with his wife, he gets in more relationship with his children. There's generally more flexibility coming within him. He dies a while later, but they said that the dying process was very different because he was able to feel this cat in his body, feel this cat as his body. So those are ways that this method can work. And so I ask her, we're going back to the sanctuary. I ask her, so sense this woman and sense that strength and stay in that body. And she does that, and she takes that with her to yoga. She takes that with her to Watsu, to the movement through the water. She journals about it. She takes it to dream theater. Throughout the sanctuary, she uses this, she takes it into the class that she's doing with Jill, where everybody is working together. So she's taking it in. Then she has the next dream. The next dream is a doctor comes into the room, and it's an African-American doctor. And the doctor is very, very eager to find out what's going on with her. And so I help her to feel that eagerness and that desire to investigate that this doctor has. And this is something that she stays in for a while. And then she has a third dream. And the third dream is actually very peculiar because it started with one of the young women at the sanctuary who had a dream about a wolf. And she started to paint the wolf and to make all kinds of drawings of the presence of the wolf, and then other people started to dream about the wolf as well. So the wolf came into the sanctuary, and actually, if you hear about the old sanctuaries, it's the dogs that are very important in these old sanctuaries. So the wolves start to come in. And her wolf, when her wolf entered into in her dream, he was walking through a field, and then he walked into the woods, and she couldn't see him anymore. But he was going to the wildlands. And so I helped her to sense the movement of the wolf, the way that the wolf was going on all fours, very similar as the cat. And as she did that, she got increasingly a sense in her body of movement. Now, it would be wonderful to say that her MS stopped and she was that, no. But she moved much better, right? She moved much better, and then her whole life began to change after the sanctuary, which is the interesting thing about these sanctuaries. When you go to a spa, usually at the end of the spa, you're at your best, and then you decline again. In sanctuaries, what happens is that at the end of the sanctuary, you're here, and then it keeps on improving. And with her, it was her whole life changed. She got into, she hadn't been in a relationship for a long time. She was now open, and she could let somebody come into a relationship and into her life. And the last thing we heard, she was on a motorbike, sitting on the back of a motorbike riding through the United States, right? And she's married, which is not usually, you cannot say that that is only a positive outcome, but in her case it was. And but it's the flexibility that came in through these characters. So again, I think that if we look at how Jung will progress in the 21st century, it is to take these characters entirely seriously. And tomorrow I will explain more how the work actually goes in its details, because it's more complex than what I'm saying, because we're not only looking at one character, but we're looking at several characters at the same time and feeling this in the body, feeling the tensions between the different characters in the body, and thereby things begin to change. But that would be too long to give as an example, and I hope that those of you who come will learn how that works. So that is what we do in the healing sanctuaries. And I think that we're in a very old tradition, and we're now reopening the healing sanctuary soon in Santa Barbara, and we're keeping on doing it in Mexico. And we hope that enough research will come out of it that it can become part of general medical care, and that medicine returns to its origins, which is dreaming. Let me give another example, and that is, yeah?
You know, I'm trying to thank you for this conversation. I'm trying to understand important themes that you're discussing. Does your approach take into account themes for reflecting the unconscious and archetypes? It does part, the first part of my question, and the second part has to do with this flashback, like going back to the flashback and trying to put some, you know, sense to the dream and trying to enact, how the person can enact that, whatever images that is embedded in that dream. Is that also, can be replicated somewhere else, somebody else?
Yes. Yeah. So the first question is about archetypes and the collective unconscious. I think that as we do the work, while we're doing the work, I'm not asking myself that question, whether it's part of archetypes or collective unconscious, or I don't think that those are parts of phenomenology. That's a part of Jung's metastructure that he put over the images. So I'm not asking that, but I know, for instance, that dogs are very important in healing processes, and so that a wolf comes up and becomes so prominent in the whole sanctuary might have a collective meaning. But as I said, I am interested in the phenomenology. I'm interested just in the experience. And when Jung goes in the Red Book and looks at the prophet and says, you're a symbol of, the prophet says, no, I'm real. So the first thing that I want to deal with is the reality of the presences of these images. So therefore, the flashback is actually the way that through mimesis, you become like the other. And as you become like the other through subtle movements and through beginning to sense, for instance, the stance of this woman, as you become like the other and you become infused by other, you move into an identification. And then you begin to experience the subjectivity of other. And that's what we're after. We're after experiencing the subjectivity of other. Now, if this can be done by others, there are now dozens of people doing this work, so it can be done by others. It's not just my work. It's the work of embodied imagination, and there are now dozens, if not hundreds, people trained in it. And so it's no longer, it doesn't depend on me. It's a method that can be learned. Was there anything else to your question? Did I miss anything? No? Okay, so this is great. So if anybody interrupt me at any time, please, that's great because then I can respond directly. Oh yeah, we're going to talk about trauma. And I want to talk about two cases. One is a case that Jill and I did in a group. And the other is something that I worked on in supervision. So the first we did in a group is a woman from Rochester who is driving her car, and it's in the winter. She hits an icy spot. The car spins out, and she runs into a tree. She is traumatized to the point that she doesn't dare to come back and drive, which is very difficult for her because she's a visiting nurse. So it really is a problem. So she presents this in the group, and I work with it in the following way. I first ask, what is it like? And so this is a memory. So you can do this not just with dreams, but also with memories. What is it like to be driving? Now, you can see from this that this is not a severe trauma, because in severe traumas, usually you don't have memories of half an hour before and half an hour after, or a period before or after, but she had continuous memory. And so I ask her to feel her driving, and then the sense of hitting that spot, and what that feels like in her body as she hits that spot and as she gets out of control. I'd only do that a little bit because it is traumatic, and I just feel a little bit of it. Then I shift the attention to, and I ask her about the trees. Now, you cannot do this if there's a severe trauma, so this is a mild trauma. To focus on the trees, and she says, these were young trees and they were bending. If they wouldn't have been bending, I would have been dead. But the trees bend with the impact. And so I say to her, now can you focus on the trees and just sense the trees and begin to notice. Again, this is through mimesis, so we're working again with this process of mimesis to get to the subjectivity of the trees, not just to her subjectivity. So we're taking it as a whole image, as a whole event, and we're moving out of the ego perspective to the perspective of something else that also exists in the same image. And so she begins to sense the way of the flexibility of the trees, how the trees can bend back. And so we slow it down. This whole process is done by slowing it down. As she slows it down, she begins to sense how the tree bends and bends and bends backwards, and she can sense this whole bending backwards until the tree can have enough bending to deal with the impact. And so now I do something that that I was talking about before. I help her to feel this intense fear of going out of control in the car, and then at the same time, this ability of the tree to bend and bend and bend, that flexibility of the tree that moves through her body backwards so that it can bend with the impact. As she feels that at the same time, she is able to not be totally terrified. She's just scared, but she's not overwhelmed with terror. She can sense the flexibility of the tree that gives space. It's what James Hillman would call soul making. Giving enough space to the event that there is the flexibility that we borrow from the trees, the flexibility that we then import into this event, and thereby she can begin to have enough flexibility to contain the event, and the result is that she could get back into the car, which was very important to her. It doesn't always go this way, this good, but we tend as therapists to give good examples. The other example that comes from from China. Jill and I trained people in China, and one of them in Shanghai was working with someone, and I supervised her in this work. This is part of a study that we did together, first here at Harvard, and then we started to move it also to Guangzhou, and then we moved it also to Shanghai, about chronic fatigue. And this is a young man with chronic fatigue. And he tells the therapist that when he was a child, he was beaten severely by his father. So I don't know Chinese culture, so I ask, is that something that happens in your culture? And she first says, yes, this happens. There's physical punishment is very strong. And so I asked her to ask him, is this stronger than what you've seen around? And he says, oh, it's much stronger. This is much worse. So it's actually, you always have to ask in the culture. If everybody gets corporal punishment, then corporal punishment by itself is more or less the norm. So you try to see what is outside of the norm. This was very much outside of the norm. And she noticed that when he told about the beating, he had absolutely no emotion. And that happens frequently, which is, of course, one of the hallmarks of trauma that is dissociated. And I tell her, now, is there anything in the environment that is very sturdy that you can focus on? And so she asks him, and she says, well, it always happened in near the well. This is in rural China. You know that China is divided in two groups. There are 500 million people living in the city and 900 million people living in the country, and it's a total divide between first world and third world. And so he comes from the country, and there is a public well, and the beating always happens near the well. So she asks him to focus on the well. And I call this working on trauma through peripheral vision. So he describes the well and that the stones are big and very strong. And so we do the same thing that we did before. We help him to focus on the well, or she helps him. I direct from, where am I at that moment? From Sydney. I help her to, in Shanghai, to focus on that well, and he begin to sense the strength of the stones, the bigness of the stones, the sturdiness of the stones, and as he becomes identified with this very sturdy well, he can begin to hear in the distance the crying of the little boy. And that's the first time that he becomes emotional. And that slowly he can allow that emotion from great distance to come closer. So that is working by way of peripheral vision. You focus on something else that exists in the image, focusing here, and as you focus here, you become identified with something over there through this method of mimesis and becoming embodied by something else, moving the attention away from ego or self, whatever you want to call it, to something else. And as he focuses on that, he can slowly begin to hear it and let it come in. And she says he becomes emotional in a way that he hadn't been emotional before. This was a very important change in the therapy that she described as essential. So these are two ways that you can deal in this method with trauma. And now we're going to leave psychotherapy. We're going to microbiology. In Australia, we trained, Jill and I trained a person who is who has her PhD in pharmacology and who is very interested in the resistance against the injections that Hillary Clinton just got them when she had her pneumonia. Antibiotics, thank you. The increasing antibiotic resistance. And that is her specialty, and so she works with a lot of microbiologists. And one of the microbiologists that she works is actually the person that discovered how Lyme disease travels. And he found that Lyme disease travels in the body of birds, and the spirochetes that are the cause of Lyme disease become dormant and travel in the body of birds, and then they get deposited elsewhere. That's the way Lyme disease travels, and he discovered that. So he's a very good microbiologist and a physician. And so we do a dream incubation with him in order to see if it will affect the way that he looks through his microscope. The way we begin is to help him to imagine looking through the microscope to see what happens as he focuses on the spirochetes and how they move, and we help him to identify with these beings under the microscope, and he can feel their movement, he can sense their movement, and that becomes the incubation. So the incubation, by that I mean, this is the seeding of the dream. We seed the dreaming. And he gets the following dream. Of course, we all wish that it was immediately about the spirochetes, but it has nothing to do with it. It rarely has anything to do with what you incubate about. The dream is the following. I'm a physician, I'm talking from his perspective, he's a physician. I'm a physician and I am coming to the bedside of one of my patients. This patient is, this is not a patient historical, this is a dream patient. This patient is lying in bed and staring up, and we help him through this method to identify with this patient, first to feel his desire to heal, his desire to be a good physician and to do something to get him back to life. And then we help him to become identified with this man by way of his gaze. The gaze, the staring. And he begins to sense the staring, and then he realizes that this patient doesn't care whether he's alive or dead. He's right between, and it doesn't matter to him whether he's alive or dead. And so as he begins to feel more and more this state in which the patient doesn't care whether he's alive or dead, he realizes that he's always looking through the microscope with the point of view to destroy these pathogens. He wants to destroy them. This point of view between life and death doesn't care anything whether these beings are these microbes are destroyed or not. So he can now look through the microscope, not caring whether these microbes are dead or alive, and thereby he can look at them much better, and he begins to notice differences, things that he hadn't noticed before. So this gets us to how you can use this in physics, and we are supported by synchronous events, synchronistic, which, by the way, I do not see in Jung's way. Jung has the notion of that this comes from a psychoid undercurrent that thereby has a quasi-causal connection between the image that you're talking about or experiencing and the outer world. I just notice that it happens and I say, that's weird. So this comes from a workshop that I do at Stanford with, and this was with physicists. And this is a physicist, a young physicist, who is working on something that I don't even know what it is. It's called high density waves. Maybe somebody here is a physicist and knows what it is. But that's what he's studying. And so we help him to focus on his attitude as he is studying them. And that is the incubation, that he is really trying to work out the mathematics of these high density waves, because he realizes somehow that the way physics thinks at this moment about high density waves is wrong. But he doesn't know how it's wrong, but he just has this feeling. So he has the following dream. I'm on the Bay Bridge in San Francisco, driving, and there are lights, and one light is there, another light is there, another light is there, then there's a light there, and then there's lights underwater, and then there's lights, and then they go up again. And I'm driving faster and faster, and as I drive faster and faster, I see that actually it's an oscillation, right? And so as we begin to work on that oscillation, and it would, of course, be wonderful that he now has discovered the mathematics of high-density waves. Sadly enough, of course, it is not that way. As we begin to work on it, we help him, or this work I do, I help him to go to the position in space where he can see the high-density waves in the best possible way. If he is too far, it becomes a line. If he's too close, he becomes overwhelmed by them and he can't do anything. So we help him to sense the exact distance that he needs to be from these high density, from these oscillations to actually observe them. And I help him to feel that in his body, and he can feel that exact distance. If he's right there, and it's a little, he describes it exactly. He says, if this is the bridge, and I'm over there to the left a little bit at this height, then I can see it perfectly. And we help him to feel into his body, or I help him to feel into his body, so that he can actually get to this place in space to look at these high-density waves. This feeling in his body, he now gets into before he starts working on his mathematics. And he says it affects the mathematics. He knows quicker whether he's on a wrong track or not, which is very important because mathematicians go on 10,000 wrong tracks. And then they find one track that's right, and then you go there a little bit. But if you go too long, you can spend weeks on the wrong track. But he said because he's now on in that sense in his body, he can quicker feel whether he's on the right track or not. So that is physics. I'll do two more, and then I'll stop. One comes from real estate. This is a person who is on the board of a very large real estate corporation, and they are beginning to work on buying a large parcel of land for which they have to get, this is a project of, I think, $100 million or more, where they have to get the investors together to buy that piece of land. And I ask her, now go to that piece of land and just sit on the land and let the land incubate what it wants. She has two dreams. The first dream is, I'm in a garage, in a very large garage, and I see that there is a little cubby hole of that garage that is being used, and the rest of the garage is not being used. Then I'm on a second dream, and then I'm on a piece of land, not the piece of land that we're buying, but I'm on a piece of land, and there is a very small parcel of the land that is being used. So there's a similarity between the two dreams. And So I help her to feel it from the point of view of the garage and from the point of view of the land. And as she feels it, she feels like she is in a straitjacket. And in her association, she associates to some of the investors who are very demanding and asking, putting all kinds of limitations on the project. But she feels it's mainly that she feels this sense in her body of being completely cramped in because only the land is totally underutilized, the garage is completely underutilized, she's in this sense. The next week, they have a meeting of the investors, and there's a very big investor, and this is an investor for $10 million plus investment, who begins to make all kinds of demands again. And she feels this same sense in her body. And she later asks around, and everybody in the room feels this sense as he's talking. And she goes to the CEO and she says to the CEO, if we keep on working with this investor, this project will never come to fruition. We will never get the total amount of investors because everybody feels like this. The CEO listens to her. They ask this investor, and this is big, they ask this investor to leave, to take his marbles and go. A week later, another investor comes who's very expansive, who puts in a lot of money, and the project runs. The project was stuck, and now it runs. So it comes through this body feeling of this underutilized sense. The last example that I give will be of the stock market. This is about a woman that we've been working with who is very much involved in the stock market. And you, the thing about this is you can only do this work with people who are very much involved in it. You cannot do this kind of work with somebody who doesn't know anything about the stock market. But this is somebody who lives the stock market, goes to bed with the stock market, wakes up with the stock market. She's completely involved in the same way as the person with the real estate deal is completely involved with it. She gets nightmares about it. She is day and night involved in it. So you have to fully involved in order for this to work. So we first begin to incubate about the stock market, and we incubate from a dream, and that is the first dream that she has when we start on this project. Somebody who's standing by, there's a stage, something is happening on the stage, but she only sees the person who stands by the curtain over there, here, and just looks in from the side. And we identify with that character, and then she gets a series of dreams. The first dream is, the third dream is, and this is a whole process, I will not tell you the whole process. What we have done is we've said, you have an imaginary $1 million that you are going to invest. And you, this is going to be based on your dreaming and see what happens. The first is about a person who controls the market, and this is an actual person who has a lot of control over the market, and he's dying. So she begins to feel the dying of this person who controls the market. And then she begins to get a whole series of dreams of gold. First there is a golden floor, then there is a golden ceiling, then there are all kinds of golden objects. And she said, maybe I should invest in gold. And so she puts the $1 million in gold. And a week later, George Soros advises everybody to buy gold. And the price of gold soars. And of course, there was a sense, George Soros was not saying this out of just picking it from thin air. There was something already going on. But the dreaming was already picking this up after the person who controlled the stock market died. So after the control sense, the controlling sense began to die, the dreaming itself began to come up with its own imagery. Its own imagery of what was happening to the market. So you can do this with many different fields. I'm bringing you this in order to see that this way of working with imagination can be done by, we've done it with novelists. There was this woman who was stuck with a novel, and we worked with her, and she came unstuck, and the book became a huge success because she could get back into it. I will not tell you the story about that. But you can do it with all kinds of different fields. This field of embodied imagination, this field that Jung began, where you just follow the images and take these images as entirely real beings. And then you let these images speak and you become identified with them and you let them take you over, then something begins to happen that is information that comes from a deeper perspective than you usually have access to. And I'm giving you all these different examples because you can do it in all kinds of different fields. And I think it's just the beginning. That's why I'm saying in the 21st century, I believe that this embodied imagination, this deep imagination that we all have access to, will become more and more prominent. So I don't think that it's going to be Jung's meta-psychology about, you all know his meta-psychology about self and anima, animus. I don't know if that is going to last. But what will last is Jung's looking at the imagination as a reality that we can access, that we can let, that can take us over, that can take us on journeys, that can take us on travels, by way we, of which we can go into what I call a post-rational state, where rationality stays entirely important. But there is something beyond rationality, this embodied imagination, this deep creative imagination that they already are talking about in the visionary cultures, like what Henri Corbin talks about in the 12th century, and these Sufi mystics that can see the way that the imagination develops, that this meeting of rationality and imagination as it comes together, I think that that's where the future of Jung's thinking is going to go. And this future has a long past. It goes all the way back into Neoplatonism, where the images have their own potency and have their own life. Not that we have to interpret them. They don't represent anything, I think. They present themselves, and as we stay with their presentation and let their presentation affect us, many different fields can change. And I think that we're just in the very beginning of it, and I think it will develop much farther, and that's how, by the end of the 21st century, the name of Jung will still be heard, but in a, for us, completely unrecognizable way that I believe is going to be phenomenological, that is going to give power to the imagination where it belongs, and thereby we will be truly in a post-rational culture that will give us information that we now can hardly dream of. So that's my thought. And we could go directly into questions, or we could or remarks, or we could pause, or we could do a combination of the two. I already see a hand go up, so.
The very genesis of your, the impetus for your coming up with this new understanding, was it in the dream that Jung had and you began to kind of build on that, the embodied imagination?
No, it began for me that I had a very severe illness, and that the illness, I was in the hospital for 11 months and they couldn't help me, and then I decided to go into analysis in Switzerland, and through the work on dreams, my illness, at least the symptoms, went away after having them for 5 years. So I believe that actually working with images has a direct effect on the body. And then I, from there on, began to look, if it has an effect on the body, it must also have an effect on the eyes of the person who looks through the microscope and all those kind of things. And then I found that Jung, because that we only have, it came in 2013 that the Red Book came out. So then I began to make the parallels. So it is it's after the fact. Yeah.
And then the other part of my question has to do with the way you approach this new, shall we say, theory? Is that a new theory, as it were, your conceptualization of the analysis and interpretation, even though within the framework of the visualization, you mentioned flashback and phenomenology. Is that a kind of, would you say, a new way of approaching interpretation of a dream?
Yeah, it's not an interpretation, actually. It is becoming identified with the characters, and the characters not only have to be cats or African women or dogs, or It can be a lantern post, or it can be that thing over there. It can be a chair. Anything can be identified with. And as you go into that identification, you get into the subjectivity of other. I call that paradoxical subjectivity. So you get into the subjectivity of other, because we've learned from very young onwards that I am the subject. And so if we move away from that and see that subjectivity is distributed, and that we, that in imagination there is distributed subjectivity and distributed consciousness, then you can get out of the ego position, and you get through the distribution of consciousness into all these different locations of consciousness. And as you do that, things begin to change, and you have more access to creativity, and you have more access to healing.
And while doing going about explaining it within that framework of phenomenology, do you not also mindful of getting into reductionist?
Well, I don't know if it is, if I reduce anything. What I'm doing is I am helping a person through these Stanislavski techniques to move out of their habitual perspective. And as they move out of their habitual perspective and they get into non-habitual perspectives and begin to feel how they are being embodied by non-habitual perspectives, then it becomes possible to therefore pick up information in a completely different way. And this can help with healing, and it can help with the stock market. Yeah?
When I first learned of and learned your technique, you used to use the word transit.
Transit,
you
yeah.
You used to use the word that you'd make a transit into the other.
Yeah.
But it seems as though the way you're presenting it now is that right from the beginning, the person is already identified with and embodied by the image. So can you speak whether
yeah.
you still do transit?
Yeah. Of course, Rick, this question would come from you. Because we worked on the thing about the bear, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We are usually identified with our habitual consciousness, our habits of consciousness. And what I'm trying to do is to get out of that habitual identification with particular patterns of consciousness. If we can get out of them, we will be more creative, because our habitual pattern of consciousness is full of redundancies. It's full of information that immediately gets absorbed in our interior algorithms, and then nothing happens because it just is a continuation. If, for instance, the light is flickering and you have a particular reaction to the light flickering, we can also get out of that habitual way of seeing it and begin to see it from the perspective of the light, and then these little shocks. So then it becomes very different. When I use the word transit, the way that I've changed over the years is that I thought in the beginning that we transit into other. And I have moved away from that. I have moved towards that the other takes possession of us, so that the agency is in the other. The agency is in the African woman. The agency is in the light that flickers. The agency is in the dog. So that if we can become identified by beginning to sense the light, we are in a different state in this room than if I'm just standing here. But it is not that I'm getting into the flickering of the light, but I let the flickering of the light take me over. And then the agency has moved out of me, and I can begin to be in this room in a different way, and I can actually get into the presence of the flickering of the light. And so that's a difference. And it comes basically from acting also, that the best moment that you can see, I'm working with a choreographer, and she shows me a film. She does the work and then works with her dancers. She shows me a film and she says, there it is dancing itself. It's no longer the dancer dancing it, but the dancer is now, you know that, Pam, the dancer is now being danced by the dance. And that's what I'm trying to get to. That the agency comes from the dance, and out of that, the dancer begins to become identified with the agency and begin to move through the dance, and the dance begins to move through the dancer, and that's the best dancing, that's the best acting. You can see it, for instance, with actors like Meryl Streep. You can see moments where the character is fully taking her over, and you can see moments where she's imitating the character. You can feel it. And so I try in the work also to become possessed by the character. That's what I'm trying to do.
I'm just wondering about the material you shared. I don't know if we might necessarily consider the representations being more archetypal, as opposed to whether or not in that incubation process people are dreaming of personal companions. I know you mentioned the wife there, but I'm wondering if this process is the same if they're dreaming of people that they actually know.
Yes, very good, thank you. And for the organizers, I can go on for hours, so you have to decide when we stop and when we have the pause. So I leave that to you. So the light is still doing its thing. Actually, when a person is dreaming of somebody they know, it becomes more difficult. Because that's why I gave these examples that are relatively simple, because the person doesn't know this woman, this African woman. So it is very pure. It's not that it's more archetypal, it's just that they don't know it. They don't know this person. If you are dreaming about your brother, then first we have to undo what you know about your physical brother in the physical world so that you can see the brother of the dream. And you frequently will find that the dream brother is very different from your physical brother. So that process of undoing it, of moving out of the memory of the day world to move to the phenomenology of the night, that is something that I will talk about tomorrow. But it is stripping off the waking associations and slowly getting to the way that this character presents itself, and then it may be a very different kind of brother. So I didn't go into that this time because it's more difficult. But and you're right, it's the usual way that we dream. But then you have to strip off all the associations first. So we start with the associations so that they are there. And Jung talks about two different levels of the dream. One he calls the object level and one he calls the subject level. The object level is that your brother is a dream about that brother out there. The subject level is that it is a representation of something in you that is like that brother. And what I am presenting is a third way, where it is neither the brother in the day world nor a part of you, but a presence that has come to you in the night that you had an encounter with, and we can get back to that encounter, and that is the imaginal way of looking at it. So I don't look at it at the object level or the subject level. I look at it from the imaginal perspective as a real encounter with a real presence, and I'm trying to get to the reality of that presence. Yeah.
So we'll go for about 10 more minutes. Does that sound okay?
Sure.
I was trained originally in dream work through gestalt therapy and psychodrama.
Mm-hmm.
And both I found to be incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how your process differs.
Yeah. There are, of course, similarities. The difference, I had a training in psychodrama in Switzerland. The difference is, in the first place, with psychodrama, if you try to become a dog, then you get a person walking on all fours and you don't get the dog. So I think that frequently acting it deforms the image. So I will not go into full action, but I will sense the subtle movements of the dog, for instance, so that you can stay in the subtle movements, not go into the gross movements, because there's this word that I think existed, but whenever I look it up, I find my name connected to it. It's called idioplasticity. It is the ability of a medium to conform to an image, idioplasticity. And the medium of the physical body is very limited, even with great actors. So if you start in psychodrama to act it out frequently, you get a deformation of the image. So I'm trying to stay with the subtlety and the subtle movements, so I don't go into full movements. That's one of the differences. Yes, exactly.
Being with.
Yeah, being with. And so you go into the subtle movement. It's much more like authentic movement, if you know authentic movement. Authentic movement stays with the very subtle movements, and you stay in these subtle movements, and then out of these subtle movements, something else begins to develop. But the biggest difference between my work and Gestalt, the two biggest differences, one is that I think that Fritz Perls was very impatient. And so he would say, become your mother. You can't do it that way. It doesn't work. It becomes terribly bad acting. And but the notion that every part of the dream is part of me, that notion I take very strong exception with. I am a radical agnostic, so I have no idea who these characters are, and I don't know if they're part of me or if they are. If you ask an Aboriginal person, they might say they're an ancestor, and or they it's the mountain dreaming, or this notion that it's part of me is part of Western individualistic culture. So I don't know what they're part of. I just know that they're encounters, and I'm trying to get back to the encounters. And in the end, because that's the only thing we know. We know we had this encounter. And then in this encounter, experience it from the perspective of the one you were identified with and the one you had the encounter with. And as you do that, shifts begin to take place. So that is the difference between my work and Pearl's work.
It seems that you're describing the original state that someone might be in, whether it's the microbiologist or the patient with the MS,
yeah,
as a closed state. It's known in a particular way.
Correct.
There isn't a lot of new information.
Correct.
It's almost that last thing where you
That's why I call it habitual consciousness, yeah.
Right. And it sounds like the contact one makes with the encountered,
yeah,
begins to bring in new information.
Correct.
Then, without an agenda,
yeah,
begins to take and transform.
Oh, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. Thank you. Thank you very much. I think that this may be a good place to end. Somebody who really understood what I was talking about. Thank you so much.